got home to North Carolina and I started dancing at these local contras and squares. And the bands were old time bands. And I was like, what is this? You know, like I'd heard bluegrass, but the old time band was just totally something different. And it's much more connected for me to like the African diasporic sounds that would have come from the original banjo, which is an African American Caribbean invention. I was just so connected to that beat and that sound. And then I just wanted to play it.
That's singer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, and artistic director of Silk Road, Rhiannon Giddens. And this is Artworks, the weekly podcast from the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Josephine Reed. As we celebrate Women's History Month this March, the National Endowment for the Arts is shining a light on some phenomenal women through the agency's blog, social media channels, and podcast. We're celebrating women who, to borrow a line from Maya Angelou's famous poem, Phenomenal Woman, have fire in their eyes and joy in their feet, which is kind of a perfect description of Rhiannon Giddens. A classically trained singer, MacArthur Fellow, banjo and fiddle player, and composer, Rhiannon excavates the past to bring forgotten stories and music forward. A daughter of North Carolina, her music has roots in her own multiracial background. Rhiannon is the co-founder of the Grammy-winning Carolina Chocolate Drops, which insisted on reclaiming a central and historically accurate place for Black musicians in old-time music. She then went on to create solo albums of haunting beauty and power, born from the African-American struggle both past and present. Always Searching, her most recent album with musician Francisco Turisi, ranges from bluegrass to gospel to traditional Italian songs. Rhiannon Giddens is an artist determined to be of service and put her wide knowledge of different musical traditions to good use. Given that Silk Road was begun by Yo-Yo Ma in 2000 as a touring ensemble of world-class musicians from all over the globe who also work to make a positive impact across borders through the arts, it was perhaps not so surprising that in July, Rhiannon Giddens was named Silk Road's new artistic director. I spoke with Rhiannon Giddens recently, and we began by her explaining what attracted her to this new role at Silk Road.
A lot of things, I think. Firstly, I'm a new thing kind of person. I'm always interested in how to do things that I don't know how to do. And if I feel like they are close enough to what I already do, I will try it. And if I think it makes sense for me, and then of course, most importantly, if I can offer something up for that role. I don't want to do something just for the sake of doing it, because that's not really respectful. But this came at a time where I was performing a lot and traveling a lot, and was a little bit burnout, a little bit just because of the intense nature of the work that I do and the music that I sing and the historical connection and all of that. And also the other thing that made me think twice about it rather than just kind of going, oh, no way, you know, was my partnership with Francesco Turisi, who we'd made a record together and we've been doing things, and he's kind of connected my music to the rest of the world. I've been doing such a deep dive in American history and American cultural music. And then he comes from the Mediterranean, and thinking about, you know, his questions of why don't we talk more about how like North Africa and the Middle East, you know, really influenced so much of European art, you know, and there's all these reasons. And so I was just kind of realizing you can't actually finish this story without looking at what came before and what's happening in the rest of the world. So look, I have so much to learn about the group, about all the instruments, you know, about the music. I have a lot to learn, but I think that's a strength to know when you have a lot to learn and, you know, what you have to offer and when you need to learn more. And they always go hand in hand, you know. But knowing him and having experimented and learned a lot about like makams and, you know, frame drums and things like this that were outside of my realm kind of gave me a little bit of confidence to go, okay, well, at least I have a little bit more of a basis to take this job. I feel like at this point, I have just enough knowledge to know what I need to know and to be open to learning. But I also have a very particular point of view, which can be really useful for where the organization is after, you know, 20 years of being in existence. That's a point usually, whether in marriages or in organizations, or, you know, you reach a point where you've been a certain thing for a while. And then you have to make a decision. Do we continue doing this certain thing? Do we go our separate ways? Do we do a different thing, but together? You know, it's a natural thing for any kind of long-standing organization, especially a group of artists, you know? All of the sort of different pieces of it seem to say, this is a good idea. And I have the people around me who can, you know, help me with the stuff that I don't know, you know, because I don't think everybody needs to know everything. I think, you know, you have to have the group around you that can kind of fill in the blanks, and so that you're each kind of doing what you're best at. And I thought I could bring a perspective.
Your own musical background is wide and it's deep. Did you grow up in a musical family? It almost seems like it was, you know, fed to you with mother's milk.
Well, you know, in some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. So I'm an interesting mix. I think I'm fortunate because I did sing a lot with my family. My dad in particular, like, we just sang all the time. We would just sing wordless melodies, you know, and he was a classically trained singer that ended up going into a different industry. But he's an amazing singer, guitar player. And so I was always around that. And I just was always a singer, like, family lore. I'm like singing as soon as I can draw breath, basically, and never stopped, and annoyed my mother to no end because I wouldn't shut up, you know. But I was in a very nurturing environment for my good fortune, because like my parents didn't push me. My dad didn't see that I was musical and then go, oh, let me get her into all of this stuff and teach her. You know, he was just like, let me just sing with her and let's make music. So that's kind of been at the core of everything. And I didn't have any formal training. I was in a choir, but then not really knowing, you know, not really engaging with it as a in a really formal sense until college. And I just think that was the best thing ever, because it meant when I got into music, I got into it for the love of it, not because I saw it could give me applause or it could give me approbation. And so I've always been into it, I think, for the right reasons for me. And I can't speak for anybody else, but it works for me. And the idea of the mission, you know, that I've been kind of on for a long time really feeds into that, because I wasn't happy until I found that mission, which is why I left opera, because I just couldn't reconcile like that I needed a connection to what I was doing deeper than just singing these stories, which is amazing. I love opera. I mean, I loved it. I love singing it. I miss it to this day, you know, in terms of not having to think about anything but singing those beautiful notes I can possibly sing and emotionally and blah, blah, blah. But I think that that's kind of informed everything.
Was that shift about wanting to connect with your own cultural touchstones?
Well, you know, I didn't have specific like cultural, I mean, I had cultural touchstones because I was born and raised in the South, but I've brought that whole idea to everything, whether it's Celtic music, you know, Scots Gaelic or old time music, you know, and again, that sits really squarely with what Silk Road is, you know, trying to do. So it's really using the beauty of art and the emotional ties that art creates with a listener or a watcher, depending, it could be dance, and then using that as a way to better the world.
Thing that always surprised me. You studied classical voice at Oberlin. And then when you came back, you stepped out of that world. That doesn't surprise me. But that you hadn't picked up a banjo until then, mm-hmm. That surprised me. First, what drew you to the banjo? And my God, you became very proficient very quickly.
Well, I like to say, you know, I don't play many notes on the banjo, but the ones that I play, I really know what I'm doing with them. You know, I'm not Chris Thiele on the banjo. Far from it. I know what I know and I stick to it, but what I know, I played a lot. And I think that that's an interesting approach, and one that is not, it's not often honored in the classical world. You know, it's like, you got to do everything with your instrument. And that is one way of making art in a very high fashion. But you know what? You can also be a folk artist that does this thing, but like amazingly well. And it has this connection to it that sometimes the other doesn't. I think art music has been taken too high you know, given where a lot of classical music comes from, a lot of classical music is very influenced by vernacular. There used to be quite a much more of an exchange there. And I think that it's just become such a classist thing, which is one of the reasons, this is one of the things that I didn't like about opera. So I just kind of burned out and of classical. I just needed a break, you know, and I got home to North Carolina and I started dancing at these local contras and squares. And the bands were old time bands. And I was like, what is this? You know, like I'd heard bluegrass, but the old time banjos is totally something different. And it's much more connected for me to like the African diasporic sounds that would have come from the original banjo, which is an African American Caribbean invention. And I didn't know it at the time, but I was just so connected to that beat and that sound. And then I just wanted to play it. So, and I didn't play fiddle either. So I picked up both of them kind of within a year of each other and just was extremely frustrated and sounded like crap for a long time. But I was very lucky because I think, and this is an experience that I wish that we all should have at least once every 10 years, is that we should learn to do something completely that we don't know how to do and try to get good at it, you know, because it reminds us of what it feels like to suck. Because a lot, you know, you kind of get good at something and then that's what you do, right? And we kind of stick to what we are good at because nobody wants to suck because it's not fun. Exactly. And that's why kids learn so fast because they suck at everything. You know, like I can't tie my shoes. I can't put on my clothes. They're just used to it. So they just approach everything with this open-minded, like, sure, I'll try to learn this, whatever. And it was such a great experience for me to be a trained opera singer. No, I was like, I'm good at singing. Like, you know, I may not be Maria Callas, but I'm, you know, I'm pretty good. I can do an opera in a foreign language, blah, blah, blah. It takes a lot of, you know-how. Now I'm sitting here sounding like a cat in agony, like, you know. And it was a really important experience for me. But also what happens when you approach it that way, I wasn't looking to be a violinist, you know, or a banjoist. I used the music to get to what I wanted, which is to play dance music or to play with Joe Thompson eventually, you know, when I met him, the last African-American practitioner of the old style black fiddle and banjo music. So you just use the notes that you need in that kind of music. When you're playing dance music, you don't try to learn all the notes. And also it's an apprenticeship. So you're doing it all by ear. And I'm not recording stuff. I'm just learning in the moment. You know, I mean, recording is important, but I almost never listened to them when I made them. We just sat and played over and over again. And then me and the Chocolate Drops would just play over and over again. And then we would play for kids. They immediately tell you if it sucks. It's just kind of like, you know, we would play for dancers. Same thing, you know, they want you to support them. And so that was the beginning of my instrumental career. And it's been the best thing ever because, you know, it's that sense of service that I think I was just talking to some folks from a conservatory. And it's just like, you know, the idea of artists being of service, I think is really lost. It's not a part of our conservatory training. And, you know, an organization like Silk Road, that's exactly what we are doing, you know, is being of service with our music. So I think it's going to be an ad nauseum kind of thing. I've been like beating the drum for the banjo and, you know, it's an African-American instrument. It's a symbol of America, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, now it's like, I'm so into this kind of looking back at my life as one of service, you know, as a musician and realizing how much that brought me as a musician, as much as I love standing there singing that high note with all the costume and just the amazing sheer awesomeness of it, doing something with my music as well brings an equally transcendent moment.
You mentioned playing with Joe Thompson, who's a National Heritage Fellow. And I would like you to talk a little more about your interactions with him because he is such an important figure in American music.
You know, we were so lucky. We didn't know then how lucky we were. I think we know now, like me and Dom Flemons and Justin Robinson, the original Caroline Chocolate Drops, you know, we started going down to meet Joe. Joe was 86. You know, at that time, and he'd had a stroke, but he kind of recovered enough to be able to play, which was amazing. And the white community around Mebane, which is where he lived, the white old-time community had been really active in keeping him playing because he wouldn't play by himself. And this is, you know, a really integral part of the kind of music that he came from. He wouldn't play without a banjo player, you know, and which is one of the reasons why I ended up playing banjo in the band because I was the only one who could. So I said, well, I'm sticking with the banjo and filling the slot that needs to be filled. I'm really grateful for that because I learned the core of how I play banjo comes from playing with Joe Thompson. And He was an amazing, gentle, I think he was aware of the importance of his music, but not enough to be too stressed about it. I don't know. I just think he knew his job was to teach. And so he taught anybody who wanted to come by, and that by teaching, he played with them, you know, and he was a really open person. And we got him for, you know, a handful of years, which was really amazing. Like, a couple of those years were really intensely learning from him and playing with him and playing with him in public. And then when John Jeremiah Sullivan's article came out connecting Joe Thompson to Frank Johnson, who had been completely forgotten, who was a Black string band musician, who was a fiddler, who had bought himself out of slavery with his fiddle and bought his family out of slavery and formed this string band, which was famous all over the South. So famous that when he, you know, they actually started calling the music he played Frank Johnson music. Like, he was hugely influential, right? And so when Sullivan connected him to Joe Thompson, it was like, I can't even explain how big of a deal that was to me. You know, in African American history, it's so difficult to get names and connections, you know, because of the nature of, you know, enslavement, because of the nature of being discarded. And, you know, most people, it's very hard for them to trace back over the ocean. Most of the, you know, a lot of people have a hard time getting specific names for their family tree. That didn't matter so much to me, but this did. I actually have a musical lineage that has a name at the end of it, which was really incredible. And we realized, okay, we're like, this is really great. We're able to do this from a living member of the African-American community, this music, which is almost dead, you know, in our culture. And then, you know, however many years later, it was like another wave of, oh my gosh, like, we almost missed that. He was 86. And it's, it almost kind of freaks you out because you're just like, oh, because it's such an important thing. And so it really does inform so much of how I look at music and how I look at the world, really, is having that experience.
Well, some of the songs you sing, you unearth. In fact, I know you worked with Sheila Kay Adams, mm-hmm. another National Heritage Fellow. And then others you write yourself, and you've been inspired to song by narratives of enslaved people, mm-hmm. bringing that past into the present. And it reminds me of Tracy K. Smith and her collection of poetry, Wade in the Water, mm-hmm. one of those longer poems. She's just using excerpts from letters of formerly enslaved people.
Yeah.
And I see you two doing very similar work in that regard. Mm-hmm. Talk about the importance of that, of filling that story out.
I think the more that we can listen to the voices, you know, I mean, it's important to listen to the analytics and the analyzers and the people who contextualize things. They have been my saviors. I've read so many incredible books by so many amazing academics who've done all that legwork that I don't have to do, you know. And that's important to set the scene. But when it comes to the emotional heart of it, it has to be from the voices. There's a lot of different ways of going at it. You know, there is looking at the voices of enslaved people, which always has to be taken with a really big grain of salt because of the different levels that the meaning has to fight through. Because a lot of the people in that, in the WPA narratives project, were very old. You know, when they were talked to, they were talking to white people. White people were sometimes writing them in dialect, even if they weren't talking in dialects. White people were asking leading questions. And it's not to say that that work wasn't good work. It was, but it was work of at the time, you know. So we have to remember that there's still a code that's happening in a lot of these narratives. So I always try to keep that in mind. And the other thing is that it's not always just their voices. For me, I also get a lot from reading letters written by enslavers, written one enslaver to another. Don't forget, here's some tips to keep your poor whites angry at the Black people, and vice versa. And there's also the voices of people who write runaway ads, people who write slave advertisements. Those are also important voices. They're tough voices because they're voices of the oppressor, but they still can uncover things that have an emotional veracity to them. So for me, the primary sources, even if within a book, their voices come clear. you know, what it means and the layers and the coding and all that stuff, that's a whole nother ball of wax. And that's where the contextualism really does come in handy, because the more that you read about the time around where these people were living, I think the more that you can intuit some of the things that were, that are coming from their words, you know, or understand why they would say this or that, you know, at least as much as you can coming as a 20th century born person in living in comparative luxury to any of these people. So that in and of itself is a barrier that, you know, that I'm very open about. It's like, I can only tell the story as I can feel it from these words, but it's imperative to me to go as far as I can to those people. That's just kind of how I look at it.
Yeah. Well, it's teaching history through song. It's singing history. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean it's didactic at all, but there's so much that music is capable of, because it opens the heart as well as the head.
Yeah.
And you're not being talked at, but at the same time, you're forced to recognize the partiality of history as it's been taught.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's a team effort. It's really important. I always kind of look at myself as the performing arts arm of the historian society, you know, because it takes so much to get this knowledge to light. But like, a musician has an ability sometimes to take a 3-minute song, and that person who's never going to read that book can get the gist of something really important from that book after listening to that 3-minute song. And I think that's where I come in. And it has felt like a service. It has felt like a call to action. You know, like, I just feel like it is the calling for me. These songs, I don't know where they'll be in 50 years. I don't really care. I feel like if they're doing their job right now, that's all that matters. And, you know, because I listen to voices or read voices, but I also try to represent the voices in a way that feels right.
Hey, Miss Collins, ain't it hard? See young Lewis in that old graveyard. The angels laid him away. Miss Collins weep, Miss Collins moan. What made her son Lewis leave his home? The angels laid him away.
So to try to get out of the way as much as I can to allow the song to be what the song needs to be.
You've written an opera called Omar.
Yes.
Which also has its historical traces. Mm-hmm. Tell me the story and how it came to you.
Well, the amazing folks at the Spoleto Festival in South Carolina, the Spoleto USA, they decided they had never commissioned an opera before, and they decided they wanted to tell the story of Omar Ibn Said, who was a Senegalese Quranic scholar who was stolen and sold into slavery and ended up first in Charleston and then ran away from his enslaver in Charleston and ended up in North Carolina. And he ended up a slave for 50 years. And he wrote his autobiography in Arabic, which is an amazing feat, considering that as soon as he stepped foot in America, like, he no longer could speak any of the languages that he spoke with people. He couldn't speak Arabic, which wouldn't have been his first language. You know, you have to read the Quran in Arabic, right? So he learned it, but he would have been very proficient in it. Couldn't speak any of his native languages. He should be able to retain the Arabic and the Quranic verses. Like, he could quote huge swaths, you know, until he died. It just shows an amazing force of will. And he's just a really incredible person. And what he said with his writings and how he walked that line, not only enslaved, but also enslaved by Christians. And so how did he keep his faith? And all of these questions were very interesting to me. I'd never heard the story. Despite being born and raised in North Carolina, I'd never heard of Omar, which made me mad all over again. Every time this happens, I'm just like, what? Why are somebody else telling me my own history? This is terrible. And so I wrote the libretto, and I partnered with Michael Abels, who is an incredible composer. And he writes film scores. He does classical composition. He's just an all around amazing guy. And I said, would you write this with me? Because, you know, I can come up with the thematic material, but I don't know the orchestra. I don't know dots. it's going to take 14 years, you know. And I just loved what he did with the soundtrack to Get Out, which is that amazing Jordan Peele movie.
Yes.
Right? And I was just like, oh my God.
With some scary music.
Yeah, he's incredible. And what he's done with What I Send Him is just stunning. Basically, the whole orchestra is a banjo. Like, I've written a lot of the music on the banjo. And it's just a mixture of folkloric kind of stuff and classical, you know, because I was classically trained. So I go into that when the spirit hits. But it's just a real, it's a patchwork of who I am. And he's really made it come to life. And, you know, he's added his own pieces to it, you know, but he's made it come to life in just a stunning way. And I think it's a really good example of fusion, you know, of classical folk fusion. I think it's a real example. I'm sure there are real examples that I just haven't heard. But for me, it feels like this is really two worlds meeting at their peak. You know, this is not an arrangement of a folk song. You know, it really is a something new. And I've never heard anything like it. So I'm excited. You know, it's been postponed and most likely postponed again. And that's been frustrating. But interest has just grown in it. And I'm so proud of what Michael and I have done. And I'm sure I've made my mistakes. You know, I've done as much as I can as a composer. I'm not a writer. I'm not writing a history of, you know, enslaved Quranic scholars from West Africa. You know, I had to draw a line and go, okay, I can do as much as I can, but ultimately I have to write a good opera that's telling the story of my Omar. This is not the Omar because he's gone. You know, all we have is his words that left behind. And again, multiple layers. Yes, real, real privilege to work on that.
I'm curious about how you're going to take some of your life's work, which has been a musical historical excavation, and bring it to the Silk Road.
Well, and again, this is where Francesco comes back in. The idea of American music is immigrant music. That's really where it begins, because the work that I've done, it's just over and over and over and over again. It's like, this comes from here. This comes from here. There's nothing in America other than indigenous music, which is a whole story of its own. Other than that, everything has been brought. So whether by force or by choice, or by forced choice, you know, depending on where you're coming from. So the fact that anybody can look at American music, you know, because this continued up until the current day. Like, it's not like this happened in 1705 and then that was it. It just kind of went from there, and it, you know, it's been American music ever since then. That's just not true. There's been wave after wave after wave, and every wave makes this huge change. And at the core of all of it is this sort of black, white, working class cultural exchange that has generated so much of what's going on. So there's all of this going on. And I'm like, so all we need to do really is to connect that to what Silk Road has been doing. You know, for me, it's not hard, because you have all of people of all of those populations that are represented by what Silk Road has been doing in America. Like, so how has it affected American music? How can we put American music back within the context of global music? You know, one of the projects that came to my mind immediately is talking about the railroad, because you have an interesting combination of a lot of Chinese laborers, which of course Chinese music has been a huge part of Silk Road music and history. And then you have African-American laborers, you have Irish laborers, you have other immigrant, you know, European immigrant populations. And you have all of this stuff going on to build a capitalist connector, right? So this railroad is not for people to get from point A to point B, it's for goods to get from point A to point B. So it's like the best and the worst of America. There's a lot of the worst of America in the railroads when you consider how the workers were treated, which was awful. How you consider the lands that they went through and stole, like native lands, to connect the East to the West. You know, what runaway economic progress does. Who does it benefit? Who does it take from? Who dies to make it happen? These are the things that we're going to explore with that project. It's like basically bringing Silk Road into America. It's like we have a lot of the same things that were going on along that route. I mean, that's been explored in certain ways for, you know, 20 years, and it's beautiful. And we'll continue to explore that. A lot of the people in Silk Road Ensemble live in the States. You know, I just think it's a really great opportunity to expose the world within America by using that historical event and the people who are involved in that as a jumping off point for creating art, for creating discussion, for that kind of thing. So that's a pretty much the first idea that I have had that we're now building into a multi-year, a really big project, because there's a lot that can be done with it that's coming from my specific perspective to Silk Road.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And the impact of COVID on planning, I mean...
It's interesting, actually. It's been difficult, but it's also been, you know, Silk Road was in a bit of flux. You know, like I said, any organization that's been around for a long time, and then also there's a transition of the original founder. So Yo-Yo Ma had stepped down, and there's this idea of recommitting to what Silk Road already is, but then also going, well, what is Silk Road right now? What's Silk Road of 2020? We know what Silk Road of 2000 was, 2005, 2010. Maybe we weren't sure, 2015. I don't know. But in 2020, it's like everything has stopped. You know, this transition has happened. You know, Yo-Yo stepped down. There was a interim artistic director model that, you know, that was dissolved. And then I stepped in as the sole artistic director. And so this is the moment where there's a reckoning that can happen within a new organization. You go, okay, so who are we now? What do we want to say? How is it structured? Everything stopped anyway. So let's take this opportunity to shore up the things we want to shore up, to change whatever, and really kind of be the organization that we want to be for now and make the work that we do count even more, more efficient, all of that kind of stuff that every organization should do. And so we've had an opportunity to do that in a way that wasn't actually as painful as it would have been if we'd had to do that while also keeping everything going. And so everybody's in their houses, so we're all available for Zooms. And so for me, it's a little sad because I haven't met 95% of the people that I've talked to in person yet. So I'm meeting everybody on over a screen, which is, you know, which is tough. But on the other hand, it's given us an opportunity to really investigate these things and to kind of come together in a way that's been really beautiful. I mean, everybody is just so incredible in that organization, from behind the scenes to in front of the scenes, you know, from every angle. And everybody's just kind of pulling for, let's decide what Silk Road is in 2021 now. And let's go. When it's time to go, let's go. But let's not wait. Let's like do what we can, you know, in lockdown. It's been a lot, actually. There's been a lot going on. And when things start to get out there again, I think we're going to be more than ready as Silk Road 2021.
And I think that's a great place to leave it. Rhiannon, thank you so much for giving me your time. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That was singer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, and artistic director of Silk Road, Rhiannon Giddens. You can learn more about Silk Road at silkroad.org and keep up with the phenomenal women we're highlighting this month at arts.gov. Just follow us on Twitter at NEA Arts. We'll keep you updated. This has been Artworks, produced by the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Josephine Reed. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.